I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Richebourg sits in the village of Vaune-Romanée. In total, Vaune-Romanée carries about 200 hectares of vineyards, 8.03 of which are Richebourg. For centuries, Vaune-Romanée was simply Vaune, in various spellings and permutations. Its famous vineyard, Romanée, was not appended onto the village's name until more recently, in 1866. The word Vaune was formerly Veona, and a few other permutations as well, and this name traces back to a Gaelic word, either Wadana, which means water, or Vedernos, which means forest. And today, Vaune-Romanée is certainly a forest of vines. But where does the name Romanée come from? It came to be the name of a vineyard when Caesar drafted Gauls from Veona, now Vaune, and later gifted them vineyards in return for their army service. One of the gifted vineyards was named after Rome. In more recent history, the area experienced about two centuries of hardships. In 1814 and 1815, there was an Austrian occupation of Vaune. About 50 years later, in 1870, the Franco-Prussian War wreaked some havoc, and then, of course, phylloxera struck Burgundy, and then two world wars, and a global recession. Now, before 1924, Richebourg was two separate vineyards, Le Richebourg and Le Verroil au Richebourg. Joining the vineyards in 1924 was something that not everyone agreed with. The two climats are different in several ways. Le Richebourg has vines planted east-west, so it gets sun all day long and usually ripens before Le Verroil. Le Verroil has vines planted north-south, and the wines from here usually have a slightly different pH. In a cooler year, you might get better fruit from Le Richebourg, but in a warmer year, Le Verroil might be slightly more desirable. The Le Richebourg climat was church-owned by the Cistercian Abbey of Citeaux before the French Revolution. And in 1791, the abbey sold Le Richebourg to Jean Foucard. He was a banker from Paris, and at the same time, he also bought Clos Vougeot. Pretty lucky guy. He would have been a good person to know back in 1791. A neat thing about the Verroil part of Richebourg is that before the French Revolution, Le Verroil was referred to as Clos de Verroil, and in part it was privately owned, though in the 1800s, the neighboring vineyard became appended onto the name, and the area became known as Le Verroil sous Richebourg. Despite their differences, in 1924, the vineyards were joined together under the name Richebourg, bringing the Richebourg vineyard to a total of 8.03 hectares. And today, if producers have parcels in both climats, they will usually bottle them together. Soon after the climats were joined under the name Richebourg, in 1936, Richebourg was named a Grand Cru AOC. It was one of the first AOCs. Today, the Richebourg vineyard is flanked on two sides by La Romanée, La Romanée Conti, and La Romanée Saint-Vivant, with Premier Cru vineyards on the other sides. After about two centuries of troubling times due to occupations, three wars, phylloxera, global recession, and a period of getting the AOC system organized, in the mid-1900s, this vineyard, the Richebourg Vineyard, experienced a sort of renaissance with the wines of Henri Geyer, who leased the Mayo Camuset plots for over four decades. Wines from this area often produce deep, rich, intense, and almost smoky wines. Keep listening to hear more from one producer who works with about 0.35 hectares of Richebourg.
It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine. And that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET. Partners with an S, .com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand. Jean-Nicolas Mayo of Mayo Camuset in Vosne-Romanée and also Nicolas J. in Oregon. Hello, sir. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Very nice to see you.
Wow. It's great to be in New York.
So you arrived in Burgundy in the late 80s.
Yes. I was very young at the time and at a moment where the domain needed family renewal because my father was actually not a vintner. And we had some tenants working for us and one of them was already very famous, Henri Geyer, but Henri was retiring in late 88, and we needed to decide what was going to be the following. And I remember my father talked to me as early as 84 about that, but he asked me, although the job was years away, he asked me to take the decision very quickly in 1 week. And he said, well, you know, I think we have a question with the domain, and I've thought it over. I cannot do it myself. Your sisters are doing something else. It's only up to you, but you do what you want. But, you know, if you say that you don't want to do it, I will probably end up selling it. So there was some pressure.
Well, that probably would have been a bad time to sell, like historically.
Historically, it would have been a bad time to sell, certainly. And probably it would have gone on for a few years. We hit a high in the late 80s, but nothing compared to what it's worth today.
So when you arrived there, what was the situation?
The situation was the situation of Etienne Camuset and the 20th century. Etienne Camuset was the vintner of Vosne-Romanée, but he had the political activities. He was member of parliament for Côte d'Or for 30 years. So he basically, at some point, let the domain to tenants with whom he shared the crop. And when he passed on his domain to his daughter, this carried on. And when the domain passed to my father in 1959, my father had already begun a career in Paris, so that carried on also. That was a very good arrangement for the time, but things were changing and it was not exactly the same. My father had begun in the 80s to sell under our own name and to sell bottles instead of selling bulk wine to négociants, and that required more work. And it was a change of times. You know, virtually all people and all families in our situation have either sold or have done the job on themselves. So it was really necessary to take that decision at some point. And so we had the domain organized with tenants, one of whom was Henri, the other were the Fourroy family, the Tardy family. Each had about 3 hectares of vineyards to care for. They were vinifying at the domain, so we had a facility, we had a cuvée, we had a cellar, but not a cellar which was arranged to keep 2 vintages. We didn't have any tractor, no team, nothing. So when I arrived, I started with a few hectares, 4 or 5 hectares. We let all the contracts go until everybody retired. I started with 4 or 5 hectares, and we had to build a whole operation at the time and build additional extensions for facilities. So it was heavy investment for at least 10 years. And it was very interesting in that many things to do at that time. And also a moment when things were changing in Burgundy.
When did that become apparent to you? When did you realize something was changing in Burgundy?
I realized it quite early on because I had some predecessors. The Lafont, Griveaux, Romier were already at the helm. And there were already some questions, some different styles, experiments, I would say, that were going on. And you could see the old world, I would say, that was still dominant, but you had really a vanguard that was already very active at that point. And I saw it quite quickly. Also, it was a time when the U.S. discovered Burgundy. In the 80s, and one of my first trips abroad was in the U.S. So that was really a leading force then. And being in the U.S., going to California also, tasting other Pinots, also made me realize that we had really turned a corner and that we could really do a great job in Burgundy, but that we needed to be really on top of it.
Was it the case that you had wine from your own vineyards at the house when you were growing up? I mean, did you grow up on these wines? I know most of it was sold in bulk, but was there an occasional Clos Vougeot?
Yes, but I was living in Paris at the time, and my father was very wary not to give us too much wine. So there was the occasional Clos Vougeot, as you put it, on Sunday lunch. Not on an everyday basis, but I was educated with red Burgundy, of course.
So in that week period where you had to make the decision, you know, it seems like a short period of time to decide your life.
Yes.
You know, I've had trouble with that for, you know, 30 years. What did you rely on to make your decision?
At the time, Burgundy was already Burgundy. It was, as you know, it relies on many years and decades and centuries of history. It was not as glamorous as it is today to be in the wine business. But still, what made the decision is that I had been, you know, as a kid, very much in vacation in Vaux-en-Romanée. My grandparents lived there, so I knew the village. And so I had roots. And I also realized this was a unique domain. This was absolutely unique to have Clos Vougeot, Richebourg, Corton, etc. And that I simply could not let that go. It's as simple as that. So it's not my passion for wine or my will to live in the country or that came after. but it's really the realization that it was absolutely unique. And, you know, I would probably have regrets all my life if I let that happen.
So I guess then that leads us into a discussion of what the vineyards are that the domain holds. So we'll start with the most prestigious, which is the Clos Saint Philibert, the white wine.
Yes. That's funny because it's a family holding we've had for a long time. It's in the haute cote and the name suggests Clos Saint Philibert. We didn't make that up. It's really the name of the plot. So it suggests there has been vineyards at times. But my father wanted to plan that, but they were waiting for somebody who do the job on a permanent basis to do that. So at the same time, my father was enticing me to come to the domain. He also laid the grounds, paved the grounds for the recognition and plantation of that vineyard, which was planted in 90. So it's above Flagey-Chezeau, still in Flagey-Chezeau, still 200 meters away from Chezeau, so that's quite remarkable. But the elevation is really different. We are at 380 meters compared to 260 in at village level. So that makes really a difference in terms of coolness, and also the soil is very stony. For these reasons, we preferred to plant Chardonnay over Pinot. At the time, you know, we didn't think, and nobody talked about climate change. So today it might be different, but with the results, I think that we were right to do some Chardonnay, because Pinot would be a little bit austere, would be a little bit difficult to ripen, and I don't think we would have a really good wine year in, year out with Pinot. It would still be difficult. So I think that with Chardonnay, you know, you can do a Chardonnay that will be very mineral. It's a little bit easier to wait for ripeness. And I think it was a very good, smart decision to do that.
When does the ripeness happen? I mean, when do you typically pick that parcel amongst the other parcels?
Well, it's generally picked last, because I want to have acidity and minerality are given in that parcel. So we need to have ripeness. And I want to have really a good ripeness with this wine. Sometimes we have some contrast between the nose, which is very ripe, and people are a little bit taken aback by the mouth, which is upright, a bit leaner than the nose would suggest. But this comes together after a few years. I think it's really important to pick ripe. So it's generally the last parcel that we harvest. So that would be 8 to 10 days after the beginning of the reds. There are some exceptions. 2006, we had to stop the reds to do the white. And in 15, we even did it before the reds. That was really the first time we did that, but Chardonnay was really ahead, and we thought that we needed to go there, absolutely.
So that was the first white wine that was planted for the domain?
Yes.
When you decided what the protocol would be in the winery for handling those grapes, in a way, that's like going to a whole new spectrum, right?
Oh, absolutely. I did all the mistakes at first, and the first one is to consider that white wine should be handled as red wine. It's not the case, and it took me a few years to realize that. So yes, white wine is different. It's more tolerant in some ways than red. You know, it took me 3-4 years at the very least to realize that my intentions were good, but maybe counterproductive. What was difficult with that wine was to understand the site. And I had to learn the site and the grape at the same time. So that I made a few mistakes, certainly. But now I think I got it better. It's a wine, it's not your usual white wine from Burgundy. It's a wine that has a combination of Chablis and Meursault, or possibly Chablis and Mâcon. Unexpected, perhaps, cross between the two. It's done in the Côte d'Or way, so I guess it's closer to a Côte d'Or wine than to Chablis. But you have this leanness and natural minerality that you find in Chablis, and acidity too. And you have a certain generosity, because it's done really very traditionally, the Burgundian way, that is fermented in barrels, a little bit of stirring of the lees, but not that many. And the protocol for fermentation is very, very standard and similar to elsewhere in the Côte d'Or.
Does it go into steel before you bottle it?
Yes, because we chose not to filter. So it goes to steel for 3-4 months. The process is quite long. I want to retain whatever substance and life there is in the wine. I think that's an important part of the process in general, and it's particularly indicated for that wine, because, you know, whatever generosity that we have must stay there. But it does lengthen the process by quite a bit.
And how do you approach the pressing of that wine?
The grapes are slightly crushed before going to the press to free the juice. I now retort to a method which is not becoming standard, but which is spreading. We protect the juice as much as possible for the free run and the early stages of the press. And then later on, I let it oxidize to precipitate what is supposed to be the bad lees. So then after we blend the two, we control the temperature. We use a little bit of sulfur, not too much, but a dose, a proper dose of sulfur, and then it goes into barrel and ferments into barrel.
And where did you get the vine material for that parcel?
It's a clonal selection. I've really wanted to have as much diversity as possible. So clonal selection for Chardonnay has been more advanced than for Pinot, or was more advanced than for Pinot at the time. So we get some fine clones. At least we have something like 7 or 8 different clones. I have a little bit of Pinot Gris also in that wine as the clonal diversity, because Pinot Gris was kind of, you know, traditional in the Haute Côte. And I wanted to have a small part of that tradition. I also thought that it could bring a little bit more fatness to the wine. It does so. And Pinot Gris is a little higher in alcohol, so it really helps with the general balance of the wine. We don't have much. It's barely 10%, but it helps rising a little bit the sugars. We generally end up at around 12.5 natural alcohol in that wine, 12.5 minus in the cold years, 12.5 plus in the warm years. And the Pinot Gris helps raise the alcohol by 0.2%, something like that. It's a little lift that I think is helpful with the wine.
Do you ferment those two grapes together, or do you?
Generally, yes. Generally, yes. We don't have enough to ferment separately.
So recently you started making white wine from the Hill of Corton. And how did the experience making the Philibert influence your decision-making and making a new white wine?
I've learned. I've learned to handle Chardonnay and not to make the mistakes, the easy mistakes you can do. For example, selection and is arguably a good idea. It's absolutely necessary with Pinot and with red wine. Not necessarily so much with white wine. It's I don't mean to say that we Chardonnay needs to be overcropped, but it's not something that you absolutely should do. So the handling of the grapes, I certainly learned from that. And after, I think we have a general handling of vinification and the press and so on, which has been useful and is now classical, standard enough that it can bring the specificities of each site together. So I don't think there are that many differences. With Corton or Charlemagne, of course, we are a little bit more attentive. But we've been blessed with very nice and consistent harvests these past few years, so it's been going on well.
How did you see the expression? Because, you know, the Domaine had made Corton red for some time in some good parcels and some good wines, but here you're making white from the Hill, and so, you know, now that you're looking through the same terroir, obviously it's different exposures, but now that you're looking through what is generally the same terroir through different lenses, what was that like?
Yes, we've started making Corton Charlemagne in 2011. So I have now 5 vintages experience. And in the last 3 vintages, it was the same plot. But in the first 2 vintages, 11 and 12, it wasn't. We were dealing with plots on the Ladois side. There is a strip of vineyards right under the wood. So high elevation, which is Corton Charlemagne, and eastern exposure, like the reds. So that would be the part that would be the closest to the reds. And this part, yes, is it seems to me richer than either the heart of the Canton Charlemagne facing south and west, and the side of Pernon, which is west and northwest, which is definitely more austere. But the southern part on Alos and between Alos and Pernon is also not necessarily the most generous. I think that the ones in above Ladois and Alos, above the reds, possibly make the most serious wine, whereas the others, they make a lighter, more mineral, more upright kind of wine and classical Canton Charlemagne.
And what have you found making those reds over the years? I mean, that's an unusual sight for you. I mean, obviously it divides the Côte d'Beaune and the Côte de Nuits, but mostly you're a Côte de Nuits producer historically. So when you were working with a Grand Cru of the Côte d'Beaune, what was that like for you?
I used to refer to the Corton in the cellar as the ugly duckling, the ugly little duckling. And I remember that because we've always had the Corton Cloronier, that's always been in our family, a vineyard planted in 27 and 28. And I remember that Henri was saying, well, with the Corton, it's difficult. You never know how to place it in the tasting. You know, there is a kind of natural progression, the Nuit, the Vaune, the Premier Cru, the Grand Cru. Corton was always difficult to place because it was a world of in itself. So we've been very lucky to have a very nice and full of potential, very big vineyard in terms of the wines it can turn with the Cloronier. And this is a wine that my father bottled regularly for the family inventory. And so I have a number of Corton from the 60s and the 70s and the cellar. And this is a powerful wine, powerful and seductive. I've had, a number of people who, not necessarily knowing wine much, so not prejudiced against Corton, I guess, who took a liking immediately to that wine. So it's a strange combination of power, concentration, a touch of severity, but also a wine which is very attractive and very sweet in all meanings of the word. So I had this experience behind me in the family. I tasted a few of these wines, and I knew the potential of the Corton, or what Corton could do, and that's probably why, you know, I've been attracted to Corton and jumped on the occasion of acquiring another Corton in 2009, and was willing to really go into the trade of white wine and do a white wine out of Corton. Also, it's certainly the reason for my attraction to the hill.
You just wanted to make the tasting order in the cellar more clear. You're like, yes, okay, so now we're going to do three Cortons.
Yes, exactly. It's a little easier now, yes.
But I would imagine that would be difficult in that tasting order anyway, because for me, you have a tremendous Richebourg and you have a tremendous Gros Parenteau, and they're so different. Like the Richebourg is so Baroque in a great way, and the Gros Parenteau is more Rococo, and it has a big flourish, but then that little bit of austerity. So I wouldn't know which one to pour first if I were to go down that line.
We usually pour the Gros Parenteau first and the Richebourg last, because Richebourg has a bit more length. And I like, to finish a tasting with the Richebourg because it lingers in your palate and goes on and on and on and on. Gros Parenteau is like a fireworks. Richebourg is really a lasting experience. So I think it's nice to stop with that wine and enjoy the experience and the length and what it can do to you.
So with the Gros Parenteau, does that change with age? Like if you taste one that's 10 years old, which I have not done, does some of that austerity go away and it has a longer finish, or is it about the same the whole way through?
It's a wine which has a slight austerity, but it goes with age. It integrates with age. I had a wonderful experience a few months ago of having wine dinner, of having a Clos Vougeot 03 and a Gros Parenteau 01. number 5 and number 6 wine in the tasting. And what was quite surprising was, of course, the Clos Vougeot was very lush from the 03 vintage. But the two wines were not that far apart. And when you consider it, we have two extreme vintages. 03 is the quintessential warm vintage. 01 is a very cold vintage. Clos Vougeot is harvested first. Copentus are harvested almost last. So very opposite wines. And there was not so much contrast. Of course, 01 was fresher. 03 was lushier. But the two wines were shared a balance, a general balance that was really a different one, but general balance that was really very nice. It was hard to define which was preferable among these two wines. Although the audience and the assistants generally preferred the Clos Vougeot 03 because it was a little less austere, a little bit easier to understand. But for me, I really recall how close these two wines were in terms of balance. So it comes with age.
So you're suggesting that the sommelier slipped you two of the same wine and then told you they were different. That's really the...
You think sommeliers can do that kind of trick?
I have no idea. But about the Clos Vougeot, I mean, it's an interesting part of Clos Vougeot.
Yes, it's right next to the castle. And it's directly linked to the history of the domain because Etienne Camuset was able to buy the upper part of Clos Vougeot in the early 20s. Clos Vougeot had remained a monopoly one century after the revolution, the French Revolution. It was first divided in the 1890s. And 20 hectares plus the castle was bought by a négociant who was a figure of his time and lots of... receptions and lots of parties going on at the Clos Vougeot. But he died in 1912, and then there was the heirs were not up to the job, and of course there was World War One. So it took less than 10 years for the Clos Vougeot, for this part, to be for sale. And Etienne Camuset at the time, of course, he had his interest as a vintner in mind, but also his political interest, and did not want to buy the whole thing for himself. It would have been very damaging on his political situation. So enticed many vintners in Vaudremenie to buy a piece. And this is why many people of Vaudremenie still own a piece of Clos Vougeot. Not all of them. The Grévaux, for example, had bought before, but you know, the Monjard, Angèle, now Eugénie, Arnoux, and so on, Mignoret, the Gros, of course, it comes from that date. And since nobody wanted to buy the castle, he bought the castle for himself with the 3 hectares right beneath the castle for the vineyards, and did not live in the castle. But so this piece is really an interesting, quite unique piece in the Clos Vougeot. The terroirs are quite different in the Clos Vougeot. Even among the upper tier, it's quite different. And there is very little soil. Soil is very shallow. It's kind of surprising because you don't really realize it when you look at the soil, at the surface of the soil. It's stony, but not extremely stony. But actually, when you dig, you hit the stones quite quickly, and at 80 maximum 1 meter deep, you hit solid rocks and you cannot go deeper, and the roots have to go, you know, between the cracks, and it's actually a very mineral terroir. It doesn't really show as such into the wine because the wine is very ripe, so the ripeness compensates the minerality. Perhaps it's the reverse, but we have, I think, for a Grand Cru, a wine which is quite pretty and perhaps less massive than a normal Clos Vougeot would suggest.
I've always liked it. I thought it was good. It's always hard for me to really get a read on what Clos Vougeot is because I think there is some disparity of parcels or so many different techniques involved in terms of the protocols for the people who make
That's true.
For me, it hits a nice middle ground for what Clos Vougeot can be.
Yes, well, you know, given the character of the vineyard, given the fact that it's ripe, but the fact that it's also pretty, we vinify it not in an extremely extractive manner, but this is a vineyard wine that you can, you know, push a little bit. And yes, I know that complexity is a given in that wine. It's not hard to reach, but so we can look for a little bit more concentration in that wine. So yes, naturally it would make a very nice wine. It's extracted slightly more than the average vineyard in our domain. So yes, I guess we hit the kind of middle ground.
Was that an evolution for you?
Yes. I need to understand the character of each vineyard. I don't have a set opinion of what a Nuit Saint-Georges is like. And of course, I have the tradition to guide me, but I don't expect necessarily Nuit Saint-Georges to taste exactly by the book, or same with Clos Vougeot. So I took this wine, and I took the prettiness of it. I was perhaps a little bit frustrated at the beginning that it didn't have as much volume as the Vaudromanée, Brûlé, or Cropartout. But you really have to rely on the intrinsic qualities of that wine, and it's a wine which is approachable, young, but ages well too. And it's a wine which is really pretty and charming. It's very often these past few vintages the prettiest wine in the cellar before bottling. You know, it has a really an harmony and a prettiness of aromatics which is really very enticing. And so build on that and try to complement the wine with what maybe is not natural in the vineyard or maybe is a little bit lacking. So we pay attention to harvesting ripe, to crop at reasonable levels. And we do perhaps one or two more punch downs. In the end, we leave the wine on the skins perhaps a little longer than in other wines. But this is basically fine-tuning. This is not fundamentally different. It's fine tuning, but you know, it's what's fun of about making wine with different terroirs. You learn to discover what is necessary and what's best for each vineyard.
So I guess that leads into my next question, which is something I've always wondered about, because you had a domain with a number of different holdings in Vaune and Nuit Saint-Georges. You mentioned Corton, Clos Vougeot. What's interesting about it is that For a long period of time, it was farmed by three different people, and they split up the parcels. And so when you arrived, did you see differences in the farming techniques based on the parcel?
Oh, yes. Things were very different. Vinification was different. The styles were different. And it rapidly came as a problem for us, selling under everything under the same Méo Camusé label. You know, with the difference in vinification between Henri and the Fauroy family and Tardy, it was not that consistent. So, of course, after the élevage made it a little bit more consistent, but one of my first jobs was to really try to bring some unity into this, which was difficult because everybody had winemaking techniques that were different, and everybody wanted to keep their own identity. So it was progressive. It was slow and progressive, but that was some kind of a problem at the beginning.
So when you looked at the vineyard parcels, and you know, Jaye had Mougère, Cropartout, and Vaune Brûlé. When you looked at those parcels, was the hedging at a certain level? Was the picking dates tended to be at a certain time?
There were slightly different things, yes. It was perhaps less so than today, than winemaking techniques would vary perhaps a little bit more between vintner to vintner today than they did then. But Henri, for example, had its ways. Pruning was a bit more conservative, I would say, and also fertilization was more conservative also, and that was the big difference with the others. Henri believed more in natural fertilizers and in reasonable amounts, whereas the others had used, as was the fad at the time, has used more potassium, which was the kind of miracle fertilizer of the 60s, brought more crop and riper crop. But that proved in the long term not to be really wise. Nobody knew it at the time. But so that was the main difference, I would say.
And did he tell you certain things that were important to him? You know, never having had the chance to meet him, I'm always curious.
Of course, his teachings were extremely extremely important. But what was more important was the really the general philosophy of the wine. He liked very central wine. He also on the viticulture side of it, he was quality oriented. So I guess that when you know, a number of young vintners at the time who came and talked with him. He told them, well, you must have quality in mind with your vineyards. That is, you must be reasonable in your vineyard. You must harvest when it's time and not because it's convenient. And so he had very basic advices on that. In terms of winemaking, he had his techniques, his canvas. And the first year in 89, we did as instructed. But I really fell in love immediately with the style of his wines. I had no need, I felt no urgency to look elsewhere. This was exactly what I wanted and what I liked. Henri was really somebody who was very very sensitive to the pleasure in the mouth, the brightness of the fruit, the texture. And he loved to eat. He loved good eating, good restaurants. He had a kind of informal club with other vintners in France, and they went and delivered their wines to the big restaurants of France. You know, the Menot, Blanc, Trois Gros, and so on. So he really loved that aspect of his job, and I think it tells something about the style of his wine. The fact that he thought that it should be very nice, elegant, a real pleasure to drink, go well with food. And I asked no question on that. I said, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do.
You know, one of the vintages that I have some experience from him, where it seems like he did quite well, given the reputation of the vintage in general, is 92. And he made a Vaughan Village that year. That was a very good wine. Mm. And I was just curious, you know, you would have recently arrived. So I was just curious if you happen to remember that vintage as well. And
It was a vintage which was a little deceiving, because it was a vintage that was very ripe, didn't have a lot of acidity, and therefore it was quite light. And this was a change to me. Generally, 92 is a vintage which is a large vintage in Burgundy, so it shouldn't be a surprise of the vintage being a bit light. But at the Domaine, I don't really know why we had made some efforts to control the yields, certainly, but I think we had a smaller crop than anyone just from the start. So we had, I had really no real reason to have wines which would be light, but this was the style of the vintage. So it was a little bit disturbing for me, because we had done 89, 90, easy, big, ripe, concentrated vintages. 91, I was very pleased with 91. The vintage was not so well received at the time, but the conditions were not as easy. It's a cold vintage, but I really believed in 91 and I was not at all disappointed. But 92, you know, the conditions were nice. Everything was right. And we end up with the light vintage. So that was, yes, that was a little disturbing. That was a little disturbing at the time. A few wines, and most notably Henri's plots, the Brûlé, the Merger, the Cropartout, of course, had more acidity and therefore are more vigorous and to this day have held up very well. The others were pretty wines, which can be a little bit deceiving, because I think that having this, for me, disappointing harvest in mind, I've underestimated this vintage. And I've told the customers to drink it early on. And arguably, it was better at the beginning between 2000 and 2005. It was better than in between 95 and 2000, notably better. So that kind of light, ripe vintage is deceiving, because you think they're not lasting. And in fact, they do last, and they do benefit from a few more years of aging. Now, of course, what is left is a curiosity. We still have, as I said, good Nuit Mergée, good Von Brûlée. Most of the 92s should be drunk or are already drunk, which is a good thing.
So it's interesting, your domain, because you have some key Premier Crus in Nuit Saint-Georges and you have some key Premier Crus in Vaune. And if you were to sort of sum up the differences between those two communes, I think you'd be in a really interesting place to do it. A lot of experience with both. So what would you say are the differences between the two communes if you were to look at it more in a large picture view?
Well, Vaune has an unmatchable elegance, natural elegance to it. It's difficult to say otherwise. You know, it's really wines that are above the crowd. They combine elegance with a certain seriousness. They have everything that a wine amateur can look for in a Burgundy. Having said that, I love my Nuit Saint-Georges also. And Nuit Saint-Georges, I think, is a bit more variable in character. You have very pretty wines. You have structured wines, and certainly Saint-Georges is an aristocrat and a bit severe sometimes, but there is more terroir diversity in Nuit Saint-Georges. You can have very pretty wines, you can have severe wines, you can have wines with a lot of amplitude. So it's a bit more difficult to define Nuit Saint-Georges, I would say. It depends heavily on the cru. Even the south side of Nuit Saint-Georges, which is supposed to be, you know, the most austere, because we think that Vaune is more elegant, so the north side should be of Nuit Saint-Georges should be more elegant and more akin to Vaune. I'm not sure this is totally true. Our Boudot is yet very elegant. The Nuit Mergée is more structured. We make also a small premier cru in Nuit Argia, which is quite structured. Very structured, I would say. And we have another premier cru that we've been making since 2003, a Nuit Perrière, which is south of Nuit Saint-Georges, which, on the contrary, is extremely elegant. So it defines Nuit Saint-Georges as a bit more difficult to explain.
And if I were to hone in on the Brûlée of Vaune, what should I know about that parcel?
Von Brûlée is a plot which is divided between two expositions, northeast and south. Where northeast? That is the exposition which is next to Richebourg. And I've had a very interesting comment from a wine journalist one day, because we were doing a Richebourg vertical, something we do, of course, every week or so. So we were having a Richebourg vertical, and as a comparison, there were a few Brûlée and Cros-Parentoux. And the guy told me, well, you know, you have a Richebourg where you're located. It's a fresh, cool Richebourg. Yes, we're located a little bit higher on the slope in the passage between the two hills. So yes, it has a touch of coolness into the wine. And he said, yeah, this Richebourg is... I love it. It's not exactly the classical Richebourg. On the contrary, your Brûlée is much more like a classical Richebourg. It's a little bit below, so it's much more like a classical Richebourg. And since Brûlée is also a very old vineyard, I think that, yes, it certainly is a wine which is very close to the expression of a classical Richebourg. It's a wine which is quite big, quite imposing, very very lush and big. So you think that you're going to have a very powerful wine, and it actually ends very spicy, peppery, in a light way, light in the good meaning of the word. It's not heavy at all. So it has a lot of a distinction between, while being very mouth-filling and imposing at the beginning, it finishes very lacy and very nice. So it's a very interesting wine. Favorite of many customers.
The Brûlé.
The Brûlé.
Yeah, I can understand why. Mm. So you've spoken some already about the differences between Richebourg and Croix Parentou, but in terms of farming, how do you approach that?
Well, Richebourg is really a very classical vineyard. There's not much to do. We pay attention to yield, but it's not a vineyard in which you have many things to correct. Croix-Parentou, on the contrary, is a vineyard which makes slightly bigger grapes. And we have to pay attention to yields. It's not terrible. We don't have to do terrible things, you know, drop half of the crop and so on. So we've reached now, the vineyard is almost 60 years old, so we've reached a good balance now. But we do have to pay attention to when it's harvested. We need to harvest it late, and we need to therefore ensure the conditions to harvest late are there. So that is, if we need an extra airflow in for the grapes, then we'll pull out a few leaves, and so that's what needs to be done. You know, everything to prepare for a late harvest.
Does the exposure differ a little bit with Croix-Parentou?
A little bit, yes. Croix-Parentou is a little bit looking to the north.
That probably leads into a late harvest.
Probably.
So I think a lot of times people say, like, that's the place that used to be planted with cabbage, and then Henri Jaillet planted it to vines. But was it always cabbage, or was it just cabbage during the war period?
It was certainly during the war period, because Croix-Parentou, you find it everywhere in the old maps. You have it in the 1855 classification of Laval, and you have it in the subsequent maps of the turn of the century. So it's just that, you know, after Phylloxera, after also and certainly World War I, World Economic Crisis, World War II, it's a difficult vineyard to work. So certainly, you know, only the easiest and the best, the very best, were kept. Croix-Parentou was not famous at the time, so it got abandoned, and the slope is quite steep. It's really a difficult vineyard to reach and to work. So I'm not surprised it ended up like that. There were reasons for that, for these cabbages or Jerusalem artichokes, I'm told. Also.
That's right.
Yeah. And of course, after World War II, conditions changed again, and were more set for a renewal for that of that vineyard.
So speaking about conditions changing, you implemented a micro-negos program at the domain to work with a number of different parcels that weren't part of the family holdings. And that sounds like it would have been an interesting challenge in a period of time when Burgundy holdings are becoming more expensive and more sought after. And so what has led to success on the micro-negos level? Because it seems like it's a challenging environment to source fruit at this time.
Well, actually, we started in 1999, and it was a good time to do that, because wine cycles are not exactly the same as economic cycles, and Burgundy at the time was not extremely successful. We had one or two demonstrations in Beaune, you know, of vintners being, you know, not very well off, which was, you know, quite rare in Burgundy. Yes, wines were available then. We chose to begin with small appellation, and this is still the case today. We very much concentrate on this small appellation, Bourgogne, Marsannay. We have a Fissin, and it was a good time to start a négociant business. Today, it's challenging, yes, because the fruit sources are scarcer and it's much more expensive. Bulk prices have been multiplied by two in just a few years. It's really difficult. It's really a seller's market. But back then, it was a buyer's market.
What have you learned over time? What's been important to the success?
It has brightened my horizons, certainly. You know, you have a kind of, when you live in Vaux-en-Romanée, even though Gevrey is only 5 kilometers away, you have a kind of theoretical knowledge of Gevrey and not a hands-on knowledge of Gevrey, why this plot is better than the other, why, you know, is you should be there. And yes, you're thinking that this is a great vineyard, but too bad, it's a bit disappointing. So it's really the broadening the horizons, getting to know the region much better, and gaining experience. That's what it's all about.
And did you make a pasta grande for a period of time?
Yes. At the very beginning, we made a pasta grande until 98. I hated the vineyard. I have bad memories of that vineyard because it's a vineyard that was located beyond the railway line. And it's a vineyard I worked when I started. So back in 1999 and 1990, I had to learn the job, and we were caring for 4.5 hectares with Christian, my vineyard manager. We were only the two of us. So I really had to learn how to prune, to do everything in the vineyard. And this vineyard of Patsutugan was so hard, you know, a 300 meter row. You never saw the end of it. And in the winter, it was very flat, very windy, very cold. I really dreaded going there. It was not very good. I didn't want to go there. And I had some success with the wine. We had some good, some very good vintages. 89, 92 was a very good vintage because the wine had natural acidity that was lacking in the vintage. So we made some very good vintages of that wine. But we made also some bad ones. And the wine was definitely different than the others, really. It was difficult to master. And I was not on top of it. And I ended up deciding that, and you know, it's a different grape. So I preferred to concentrate on a Bourgogne Rouge that would be very much an introduction to the greater wines of the range. Whereas the Pastugain, you cannot say it's really an introduction. You cannot really understand what the style of the domain is about. And it's much more difficult to relate to Clos Vougeot and Richebourg and to imagine what it would be with the Pastugain than with the Bourgogne Rouge. So my motivation was low with Pastugain. I'm afraid I'm responsible for really not making that wine anymore.
Seems like a fair decision to make. So I think a lot of times when you look at the old books on Burgundy, you know, old by which I mean early 90s books, they say Mayo Camisay, 100% new oak, always destemmed, riper, bigger fruit. What would you say?
I say this is true, but there has been some evolution since. Henri did not like stems at all. And he was very frustrated with some of our peers who use stem extensively, and he didn't like the type. Nowadays, stems are very much in fashion. And so it was not the case in the 90s. So, you know, it's the debate between the two is really as old as red wine in Burgundy. So I've experimented with stems. I've done in one vintage, a cuvée of small cuvée with 80% stems, really to know how to vinify that and what were the result in a Mayo Camisay environment. And this is definitely not my preferred style. But I've experimented with it. I've done 30%. I've done, you know, the same cuvée, 30% versus zero. So I really can speak about what it is to how it is to vinify, what's the evolution thereafter, and so on. Now we introduce with great caution a small percentage of stems in some vineyards, in some wines. It's generally no more than 10%. It really does some wonders to bring a little bit tannins to the wine. So sometimes a little too much. That's why it's really maximum 10%, bringing a little bit more volume texture to the wines, because you have more tannins. So therefore you have also more softer tannins that combine with color, stability of color. At this level, it really is not, you don't lose color. You don't have the same kind of pale wine that you can end up with when you're using 80% stems. It works the reverse. It definitely adds some austerity and some, fresh in the sense of mint, eucalyptus aromatics. So in terms of complexity, it's a good tool. It's a good tool. But of course, at 5 or 10%, it doesn't really change our style. It's a tool, and definitely the higher proportion of stems is something I respect, but it's not what I prefer.
And what about cold soak? Do you do some period of time?
Yes, cold soak is almost always done. So we want to have the grapes as intact as possible coming to the winery, and we destem, as said, and then if the natural conditions have not been cool enough, we cool down to approximately 15, 16 degrees Celsius, not more. And generally it's enough for the wines to stay at that temperature and for 4 or 5 days at least, and go on their own fermentation towards the 6th or the 7th day, on their own, very, very slowly, progressively. Some years which are very cold, it has happened that we harvest at, we end up with grapes at around 10. It takes a very long time. It takes 8 to 10 days to start. We generally have to warm the grapes, but this is not a temperature I'm looking for. 10 is too low, and doing a cold soak of 10 days versus 5 days brings absolutely nothing. There's no advantage. The cold soak is it's really the early days that that matter.
And how fast do the reds typically take to do mallow?
A good 6 to 9 months. What is standard is that it quiets down during winter and it resumes in March, April, when the cellar becomes a little bit warmer.
Because it's a cold cellar, in my experience.
Yes, it is a cold cellar. And also we have wines which are number of times quite low in pH, so the mallow is not triggered immediately.
And what about the cooperage?
We have moved away from 100% new oak everywhere. We still have a high proportion of new oak, especially on the Grand Cru. It's still close to 100%, but we've decreased with Premier Cru and Village. And also, it's outside the proportion, we've also worked on the provenance, the type of grain, and the toasting. That was most of the work that was done, experimenting on these factors, because a higher toast is certainly flattering during élevage, but it's deceiving also, because you get a lower impact on the wine at first, and you say, oh, everything is fine. And then you end up after 12 or 18 months with wines which are heavily toasted, and it's not what you want. So choosing a light toast, which is a little bit scary at the beginning, because you feel the wood, you're really chewing the wood. But I found out that the integration after 12 or 18 months is much better, and it's much more subtle, translates into a little bit of vanilla, licorice, cinnamon, caramel kind of aromatics, which are much more subtle than just, you know, coffee or toasty or bacony, which is very simple. So that was a first step. And then to try to find also the best type of grain for each wine, the best mix. And it's tricky because you know, it's not very scientific. It's not an exact operation. Wood and oak is variable. It's not an industry. It's not exactly replicable. So it's really it's a tendency. You have general tendencies, and you have to be able to replicate and to know what a certain type of grain will end up with, combined with Clos Vougeot or Richebourg. And you have to find what's the best match and edge your bets too. That is, we know that a certain type of oak can be great. It's great, you know, two-thirds or 75% of the time, but the remaining can be a little too heavy. So, you take the risk because you think this is great, but at the same time, you don't want to have all your wine in the same type of barrel. It's not advisable.
What's your approach to racking on the reds?
Yes, we've usually had the habit of racking at least once during the élevage and another racking for the preparation of bottling. We tend to reason that more nowadays and not rack the wines that don't need it. You know, we have wines which have a very nice evolution, and I mentioned Clos Vougeot, which is often the most pretty wine in the cellar. And Clos Vougeot for the past 2 years did not seem to need a racking. It didn't do anything to the wine, and perhaps quite the contrary. On the other hand, we now have wines, we also have wines which are a bit more austere. We have some reduction in some wines, and this is a problem which is pervasive in Burgundy, and in my opinion also very linked to the viticulture, although it's difficult to make sense out of it, but it's linked also to organic viticulture, I think. So we have to deal with this, and some cuvées and some vineyards are more prone to reduction or to being a bit tight, and therefore need an intermediate racking during the élevage.
Do you find that reduction out of a vineyard is linked to nitrogen or to vegetative growth? Do you see more green matter in the vineyards that are showing more reduction?
It's difficult to link it 100% because there are some vineyards which defy the model. But it seems to be more pervasive in vineyards with a high acidity, colder climate vineyards. I think it's mostly an exposition factor. We think it can be linked to odium, mildew, powdery mildew, as you call it here, and the fact that some sites may be a little bit more sensitive, and therefore we use a bit more sulfur. Although, you know, the sulfur factor in the vineyards is not, I mean, it's certainly not the only one, or if not even perhaps the main one. But I seem to find that, yes, the cooler vineyards have more reduction issues.
So looking back, what have been the key realizations for you, besides what you already said?
Vintages I've enjoyed a lot are 99.
It's a good Mayo year. It is.
Thanks. It was perfect. 99 was perfect. We had a big crop, but I was, you know, we were aware of it, and we did what it took to take away some of the excess of that crop. So it was large with us also, but it was not over large, and we had almost 3 weeks of good weather, not too hot, but good weather before. And it was really ripe and having great balance. We harvested before the rain, and so it's. I think it's a vintage in which which was really right for us. I love 03 also because 03 was kind of panicky. And you like it when you think that you're on top of things like 99, but 03 was totally the reverse. Very upsetting. And by the way, I think this is why a number of my of other vintners don't like 03. A number of them really say, oh, I don't like 03. And even at the time when, you know, generally vintners, they want to sell and they say this is the best vintage ever, whatever the vintage. But 03, it was a little bit different. People were certainly put off guard. But it has taught us great lessons, 03, that, you know, the vineyards can take care of themselves, that maybe in a given year, the best is to change nothing. Because in 03, that's, in retrospect, that was the best strategy. Change nothing in the vinification. And don't imagine that this is a vintage that will not end up having, yes, its personality, but being a good vintage for what it is. And so it was a great, great lesson, 03, in that in that respect. And of course, I've liked other vintages also. I've liked 96. 96 is a quintessential cold vintage, meaning by that it's not necessarily bad weather vintage, because the weather was actually very fine. 15 days of good weather before harvest, but wind coming from the north, so a very cool harvest. Lots of acidity remaining in the grapes. Low temperature ripening, and today a vintage which really has, yes, evolved, but remains very fresh and lively. So that kind of vintage is really also absolutely typical of Burgundy. You can have ripe vintages elsewhere, and you have many ripe vintages elsewhere, and ripe in the meaning of ripe and sweet, but ripe and lively and acidic, you can do only in Burgundy. So this is a very specific character of our wines and vintages, and I love that when it happens. So it's difficult to master, but I really love it.
I feel like when people open wines from that vintage today, that's what they comment on, is the acidity.
Yes. Well, it's been really something which is certainly disturbing, because the acidity, in general, these vintages, they are great on the nose because they have really that fresh basket of fruit. And you find black fruit, you find red fruit, and it's really jumping out of the glass. And the mouth is much more austere, more upright, and sometimes biting with acidity in the early years. It is also vintages and types of wines which are more difficult to pair with food, because they are very sensitive. If the food is too sweet or too rich, too creamy, it makes the acidity even more prominent and the wine tastes totally imbalanced. So on the contrary, I've had from sommeliers also a great comment saying this is wines which are very good with the food, in the sense that they are lighter. Yes, generally they're lighter than ripe vintages because they have a bit less alcohol, so you can drink a little bit more. That is for sure. But in general, they're, I feel, little less easy to handle. It's not vintages that you can drink as an aperitif. You have unique food with it, and not necessarily every kind of food. It goes very well with fish, actually. That would be a good match for that kind of for that kind of vintage. But the charm and the liveliness of these vintages, especially when they are they have a few years, is unmatchable.
Was 04 a challenging year?
Yes, 04 was a challenging year. It was a challenging year because it was a large crop. August was difficult month, and 04 was very ripe, contrary to what is generally thought, very ripe. We reached 13.5 without a problem, a bit light, and had this green aromatics that we discovered only after bottling, unfortunately. And we didn't think and we didn't find it before. What was supposed and would have been a very charming and easygoing vintage, not extremely serious, but nice and easygoing, rewarding vintage, ended up being a little green and displaying some severity, some greenness in a very unexplicable way.
Has that gone away some in bottle?
A little bit. It's more combined now. It's more combined, so it's mingles with secondary aromas. And yes, it's much more acceptable now.
On the other hand, 2015 seems like a vintage where everything went right.
Yes, it's a great vintage. It's a great vintage. It seems to be a great vintage. The wines are finishing malolactic now, so they're a little bit at the bottom of their form, but it's I've no doubt it's going to be a great vintage. It's a vintage which has great ripeness. It's high in alcohol, around 13.5, which for Burgundy is high. We managed not to be beyond 14. We have just one or two wines which are, you know, touching 14. But I guess this was the pitfall of the vintage, and it's it's deceiving, these vintages, and especially like in the past few years in Burgundy, contrary to what many people imagine, the alcohol levels were not very high. So 2015 is the first vintage since 2009 when we reach and go over 13, and when we reach 13.5 everywhere. The vintages between 09 and 15 are more around 12.5. So I say that because in 15, we believed at some point that the grapes were slightly unripe and that we could let them sit in the vineyards for a longer time, because it seemed that the sugars were not increasing and that maybe, you know, the conditions of the previous years was repeating itself and that they would not go over 12.5. But in the end, you know, it's that kind of vintage where it's the weather was very calm and perfect and warm and no variation in the weather forecast. At the end, it turned out to be, it turned very quickly. You know, it's almost, I say almost because it's not a large crop, so... But to make people understand, it's almost as if it was underripe, underripe, and the next day overripe. So it was that that quick. It happened in 09 also, which was less surprising because the crop of 09 was big. But it happened in 09 where in 48 hours you almost go to a situation where the grapes are overripe, slightly overripe. So 15, it was a little bit that way. So very great, nice harvest, less worries, you know, no watching the weather forecast every 2 hours for the next rainfall. So very relaxing harvest. But at the same time, as always, a vintage which had its pitfalls.
So that's one climate. But now you're making wine also on a consulting project that you're involved with heavily in Oregon. And how did that come to be? And how's it been so far in the three vintages that you've been there?
Well, first of all, it's not a consulting project. I'm really involved in that project because I'm the part owner of that project with my friend Jay Boberg, and it's now real, and we have some partners, of course, and some investors, but we are the two ones that drive the whole winery.
In what way did you get that project started?
We have, with Jay, we have a 30-year-old friendship because I met Jay when I was in school at Penn, and his sister was in the same program as I did, and Jay came to see her at some point, and we had, Jill had thrown out a party, and Dave was very much into wine already. And so when he knew that I was going to be in the wine business and was having a nice estate in Burgundy, he became very interested, and we have nurtured a friendship since. And so when Jay was has been involved in the wine business, and so when he moved somewhat away of the wine business, he really looked into having a kind of second career with wine, his passion of always. And Oregon seemed a very rational choice. And since his choice had been Oregon and Pinot, he thought of me to help him with this. And it's true that at the beginning, it was a consulting project. And we moved away from that aspect of things quite rapidly and decided to start on our own from scratch. Recruit some investors, some friends to come with us. And I became very, very involved in this endeavor. And it's been very personal since.
And the three vintages that you've worked there, what have you discovered?
Many things. I've discovered the potential of Oregon. I knew about it, but it's something to know it theoretically or to taste it and then to experience it yourself. So I really think that Oregon is has a great potential. Some of this potential is already evident. Of course, it's also yet to come because the vineyards are quite young still. And I'm absolutely convinced that there is a big difference of complexity between a young and an old vineyard. And we see it in Oregon also. So the potential is there. The one of the main differences, I would say, and what is somewhat unsettling for a Burgundian is to vinify wines and grapes with far less acidity than in Burgundy. I guess that an Oregonian coming to Burgundy would find the reverse, is how to vinify grapes with less ripeness than in Oregon. So this is the main difference between the two regions, and it has vast implications. The canvas of vinification is the same, but then you really need to adapt what you do in Burgundy, because not every recipe in Burgundy is can be applied and or can be applied at the same time. That's the timing is really different.
But tasting the 14 Nicolas J, the Pinot Noir, I was struck by how much there was a family resemblance between the taste, at least in the fruit profile, maybe less so in the structural part, but in the fruit profile, I was struck by how much the family resemblance between the Mayo wines and the Nicolas J.
Well, thank you, but it's not a surprise because the techniques are really similar from the outset. And after, we need to, of course, adapt. And naturally, the conditions are not the same. So, I haven't come to Oregon to make Burgundy, and fortunately, because it would be impossible. But yes, I think that the principles can work in both regions. So it's not the contrary. Yes, it's not the contrary. When you compare it to Mayo Camuset, the wines are riper, are more generous, are less laid back, perhaps, and less reserved. But the texture, the fruitiness, yes, these are things I like and that are enhanced in that wine also.
It seems like the vintages that you've worked in Oregon are also the vintages that have been fairly warm recently. Have you encountered that?
Yes, 14 and 15 have been very warm, less so 13, in which we did a trial cuvée, a cuvée zero, I would say. But 14 and 15 have been quite warm, yes. It's something which is nice because we have a very forthcoming and appealing vintages and wines. It's easy to understand them. Of course, when you want to also make balanced wine, these are vintages which present a set of challenges, and you want to do everything you can to preserve the fruit, the freshness, the balance, the prettiness of the wine, and not end up having something that will be syrupy, boring, heavy, too sweet, and so on.
So what works for that? Is it a foliage thing? Is it?
No, it's keeping that in mind at harvest, that it means first to not to harvest too late. And we were pretty early in 14, but even earlier in 15. I think Oregon can ripen grapes without a problem. We still, of course, need to find the right balance for each vineyard, but it's we should not think that Oregon has a problem to ripen, especially compared to California. It's not true. It's coming from Burgundy, I can assure you that there is absolutely no problem to ripen grapes and Pinot in Oregon. So I think ripening not too late is important to keep the freshness and the balance, and to keep in mind that this is Pinot Noir that we do, and Pinot Noir is perhaps not the best grape to make Syrah.
Is the water retention of the soils different in Oregon than in Burgundy?
Yes, certainly. Of course, the soils of both Oregon and Burgundy are very diverse, so it's difficult to generalize. But I've been surprised in Oregon by the dry conditions. Most, a majority of vineyards are not irrigated. And 15 has been very dry. Some vineyards have suffered, but not as much as I would have expected under that kind of conditions. So the soils, it seems to me, the soils are quite deep, profound, more profound in Oregon than in Burgundy, but poor. And therefore, you know, the depth of the soil is certainly a factor in water retention. It keeps some humidity deeper on. Whereas in Burgundy, it's more the texture of the soil which plays a role in the water retention.
And what kind of vine material are you working with?
In Oregon, it's mostly clones. So there are the traditional clones available in America for Pinot, that is Pommard and Vaudensville, and also the what is called the Dijon clones, 777, 667, more recent clones, the 115, which was developed in the 80s, are the most pervasive clones. It's... Of course, I would like to play with more clonal diversity in Oregon. The quarantine process is long and cumbersome, and certainly has slowed down the spread of other clones. It is also a factor I understand very well when you're planting a new vineyard, you don't exactly know what to expect, and having and playing with clones which are known helps kind of alleviate the uncertainty. But I would certainly like to have other clones introduced to Oregon. I think it would be good for the diversity. Having said that, Pinot and these clones are no different. Pinots are prone to variate and diversify very quickly. So it's a matter of time, then a 777 planted at some place will, over a number of years, be notably and evolve notably different than a 777, the same 777 planted 10 or 20 kilometers away.
So 20 years from now, what do you see as at least the goal for the Nicola J project? I mean, what's that going to look like in terms of releases?
I see we currently do Willamette Valley Cuvée, which is a blend of many different aviers in the Willamette. And this is going to remain the core of our offerings. We will refine that blend, of course, over the years, but our objective is to make relatively widely available a great wine from Oregon. We are aiming at, in a number of years, making around 60,000 bottles, which you can liken to a small to middle-sized domain of Burgundy, probably the same in Oregon, perhaps a bit smaller compared to the average size of domains in Burgundy. But for the moment, we remain quite small, around 20,000 bottles. And we will certainly develop also a single vineyard program or a premier cru program. I don't want, out of superstition, to speak about Grand Cru yet about Oregon. But of course, coming from Burgundy, I'm absolutely eager and highly motivated by the possibility of discovering some great terroirs and nurturing these great terroirs as well as we do in Burgundy. So this has already begun. We've set aside two wines that we think are special, very small quantity because we need to see how they evolve and we need to still watch them before going a bit more in that direction. But this is certainly our goal, to single out 2, 3, 4 perhaps very special wines that we like.
There's some good terroirs for Gamay up there. Maybe you could, you know, try again on the Passegrain thing.
The motivation is low, unfortunately.
Jean-Nicolas Mayo would like to make great wines more widely available. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Jean-Nicolas Mayo is the proprietor of Mayo Camusé in Vosne-Romanée and a partner in Nicolas Jay in the Willamette Valley of Oregon.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.